Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do you relate to time? When you think about your past, do those memories give you comfort or cause anxiety? If you live for the present, is that because you want to enjoy the moment or because you feel powerless to control your destiny? And when your eye is on the future, do you tend to plan for the things you know are coming, deadlines, obligations, retirement, or do you prefer to focus on the promises of the afterlife? Research reveals that different people tend to relate to time in distinctly different ways, which can make shared goals or even good communication a challenge. And my guest today is convinced that while our perspective on time affects nearly every thought we have and every action we take, most of us are hardly aware of it. Philip Zimbardo is professor emeritus at Stanford University and past president of the American Psychological Association. His latest book is co-written with John Boyd, who is no relation to me. It's called The Time Paradox, The New Psychology of Time That Will Change Your Life. Philip, welcome back to Think.
Oh, great. Great to be back, Chris.
Can you start by talking about the aspects of our lives that are affected by how we perceive time?
Yeah, our new book summarizes 30 years of research that I've done with John and other students and colleagues. Actually, I started right after I did the famous Stanford Prison Study back in 1971, in which we put good boys in a bad place to see whether the goodness of the boys dominated or whether the badness of the place dominated. And sadly, bad situations overcome good people. While we were doing that study, the time sense of the prisoners especially, and mine, because I was working almost around the clock, got distorted. Every day felt like several days. We couldn't even believe that it was only a week before I had to end the study. And so that combined with my early childhood experience of being a poor kid growing up in the Bronx with a Sicilian family that lived in the total present, made me think that time is something that we really should study. And you know, I did a literature search, and there was almost nothing written about your wonderful introduction, how individuals partition the flow of their experience into these temporal categories, time zones, if you will. And so we started studying it, doing interviews and surveys, and developed a scale that I have in the book, we have it on our website, where people can determine what is their time profile. And as you said, there are really six time zones that people live in. Some people live in only one, or some people one or two. And it's past positive or negative, present hedonistic or fatalistic, future-oriented, or what we call the transcendental future. The important things occur after you die, when there's hopefully pie in your sky.
Yeah. So our ancestors, thousands of years ago, really didn't have to think a lot about time because they were really centered in the present in order to stay alive.
Yeah, survival. I mean, if you're in a survival situation of any kind, even to this day, when you're in an emergency situation, you know, the past is irrelevant. You know, the future is irrelevant. You have to make a decision. What do I do this next moment to live, to survive? And, you know, our ancestors were good at that. Also, the different time perspectives also depend on the development of areas in the brain which process memory versus process future expectations. So, for example, young children have a very limited sense of the future because the frontal lobes, the part of the brain that is involved in planning, and especially in planning, has not developed sufficiently.
So, in other words, they would then mostly focus on the present. But there are plenty of adults that still do this.
Yeah, well, that's the interesting thing. We see, in a sense, Chris, we all begin as present hedonists. That is, we all begin at the breast or at the bottle, and we live for the moment. We live, you know, essentially, we are surviving creatures, that we live to seek pleasure and sustenance to avoid pain. And some people stay there. Some of my good friends, the kids I grew up in the Bronx, you know, just stayed at that level, because to become future-oriented means to learn a new way of thinking. It means to learn delay of gratification, to give up in what's good now because it might have a bad payoff in the future. And so that's the, I'm arguing the main purpose of school is to take present-oriented little beasts, like we all are, and transform us into productive, future-oriented citizens. And it works for most people most of the time, But for a variety of reasons, for some people, they just stay stuck in the present.
And so what are the risks of being stuck in the present as an adult?
Yeah, the big argument, I mean, the reason we call the book The Time Paradox is that, as you indicated in your opening, that I argue that time perception, I'm sorry, the time perspective exerts a huge influence over all of our decisions, and we're unaware of it. And the second paradox is any one of those time frames has lots of good things associated with it, but in the excess, they're outweighed by the cost. So if you're present-oriented, present hedonist, you have lots of friends. People like you. You're there for them. You're like a child, no matter how old you are. You like good food. You like talking. You like playing. You explore. You know. You explore everything. You're looking for new sensations. And the problem. So that's all good. That's wonderful. The problem is that you are open. You are at risk for all addictions. Because you go for what is good now, what feels good, what tastes good, what smells good, and even though you know it's going to have, it could have a negative consequence, that smoking is going to lead to cancer, that unsafe sex is going to lead to sexually transmitted disease or pregnancy, gambling too much is going to lead to getting debt or being broke, that future, that those future thoughts do not feed back to change your behavior, so you become addicted to all of the things that are going to undo you.
And it's, I guess, a similar situation with people who are what you call present fatalistic. These are people who don't necessarily enjoy the moment that they're living in, but don't feel like there's any point in trying to control what comes next.
Yeah, see, to be to be present hedonist, you know, to be present, mildly present hedonist is wonderful. In fact, one of the things we're arguing in the book is that, you know, most of the books in the past on in quote, time management are really focused on getting people more future-oriented to do more in less, manage your time so you're more efficient. And we're saying most people in America are too obsessed with the future, that you need a dose of hedonism, that you need to take pleasure in life in addition to work in life. But present fatalists don't take pleasure in life. There's nothing good about being a fatalist because it says it doesn't pay to plan, nothing works out the way I want. The present fatalist is somebody who ends up saying, I control nothing in my life. I am ineffective. And so it promotes a sense of hopelessness, a sense of helplessness. Now, if you're really in poverty, in one sense, that's a realistic take on the world. You're the last to get hired, the first to get fired. Your life is controlled by economic conditions outside of you. But if you have that time perspective, then you're never going to do anything to change, and you're going to stay stuck in poverty.
So let's talk about the sort of evolutionary introduction of people who are future-oriented. Suddenly you have agrarianism, and it matters very much that you think about what's coming ahead. You plant a seed instead of eating a seed.
Yeah, well, one of the things, so the way I would lead into the answer to that is, all research done by anthropologists, sociologists, indicates that the closer you live to the equator, the more present-oriented you are, meaning so if you live above the equator, people in the south of virtually every country are more present-oriented. If you live below the equator, that is, if you live in the north part of a country, the more present-hedonistic you are. And that's because nothing changes. The physical environment in the tropics is relatively unchanging. You never plan, you know, for the next season because there is no next season. But once you develop an agrarian society, then, you know, it's, you have to plant, you have to sow, you have to reap, you have to have fertilizer, that everything is about what's coming next. And so a future orientation is really all about what do I do now to reap the rewards at some point in the future. Well, that is the same as what does a student have to do now in order to get the A grade? What do I have to do now to collect enough A grades to graduate at this level? Once I graduate, what is the next goal? So to be future-oriented means setting goals, having a vision of a future in which there are all of these wonderful possibilities, and then planning from where I am now to where I want to be. And to be successful in any technologically oriented society, any capitalist society, you have to be future-oriented. And the people who don't suffer, the people who don't stay poor, they stay in the lower classes.
And there's an interesting conundrum here, because we've seen a lot of recent studies that say that, that children who are particularly poor in accepting delayed gratification, and as you've mentioned, all children have a tough time with this at first, but the ones who really can't deal with delayed gratification tend to do worse in school. Meanwhile, you have found that, that there's a direct correlation between a high level of education and this future orientation and success.
Yeah, it is a cycle. Let me tell you, this is this wonderful study that was done some years ago by my colleague Walter Michel. He was at Stanford, then he's at Columbia, and it's a very simple study. It's a study that every parent should do with their children. You play some game, and if the kid gets it right, you say you've won a treat. And do you like marshmallows? If so, you say here's a marshmallow or here's a little chocolate candy. But if you wait until I come back, I'll give you two. Now, of course, it makes sense. If you like it, it makes sense to wait. But the child is alone, and right in front of the child is the temptation, this big, you know, marshmallow, this lovely piece of chocolate. And so the question is, who waits and who eats? Before the age of four, almost no child waits. And as I said, I think that's partly brain development. At four, many children can't wait, but many children do. As you get older, more and more kids wait. But what he found was he went back 14 years later when these kids were at college age level to interview the kids, to test them, find their background. Those children who waited at 4 years old when they were 18 scored 250 points higher on the verbal and math portions of the SAT. That's enormous. The kids who could not resist temptation, the kids who could not delay, more often likely to get in trouble. They didn't persevere. They were kids who were more jealous, more envious. I mean, it's a positive versus negative picture. Kids who stayed present-oriented, their life was just less productive, less effective than kids who delayed, which means, in our terms, means they were beginning to develop a future orientation.
How do we know that, that ability to deal with delayed gratification at, say, age four wasn't already due to a higher level of intellect at that age that would also correspond to higher scores later?
Well, we don't know. It's a great question. We don't know that because at that time, since he didn't expect to have, you know, this big after effect, that they didn't, what psychologists say, they didn't control for intelligence. Mm-hmm. That is, In redoing it, you would control for intelligence. Say it was not IQ; it's really a motivational thing. It's really how do I envision the world? Now, there, you know, all addicts know that if I take some cocaine and heroin, you know that the risk of addiction is high. The problem is you're in a social situation; other people are doing it. People are saying, "Come on." Come on, do it. Don't be a sissy. You're in a gang. You want to be liked. And suddenly you start doing it. And once you start, then you can never delay gratification. So as I said, all addictions, gambling, food addiction, sex addiction, drug addiction, are all about people making a decision based on the immediate now with the future. You know if you overeat, you're going to get obese. If you get obese, it's going to lead to diabetes, and you could die. You will die earlier. You know if you smoke, the probability of getting cancer is much higher than if you don't. And the question is, you know, future-oriented people look to those other people and say, how could you keep doing this stupid behavior? It's not stupid, it's time-centered.
Philip Zimbardo is my guest. He's professor emeritus at Stanford University and past president of the American Psychological Association. His new book is called The Time Paradox, The New Psychology of Time That Will Change Your Life. After the break, we will talk about how you can change your perspective on time. And you can join us with your calls at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
Now You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Philip Zimbardo. His new book is called The Time Paradox, The New Psychology of Time That Will Change Your Life. If you want to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about the past for a minute, Philip, and let's start with this. Do we have the ability as humans to be objectively accurate with the way we remember our own past?
Very few of us do. We like to think of the past as like a video recording that we carry around in our brains, that you, when you take it out, you replay it, it's the same thing. When I look at an event and you look at the same event in the past, it's the same videotape. There's just a ton of research in psychology by cognitive psychologists, by social psychologists, say that's just wrong. The past is a psychological construction that we create in our minds, a view of what happened then. And that's influenced by the emotions we had at that time. It's influenced by the emotions or our health status even at the time we remember, which could be 5, 10, 20 years later. So in the extreme, a lot of the past is fiction. We remember things vividly that never happened. There's much research by Elizabeth Loftus, the University of Irvine, that documents that people are sure they remember something that never happened, that as a child, you know, you went to Disneyland with your parents and you got lost when you never went to Disneyland and you never got lost, because we know. So one of the things that happens is we construct a past that could be much more positive than it really was, that you remember all the good things. You remember the family rituals. You remember, you focus on Christmas, you focus on birthdays, and that's wonderful when you do. Other people, however, you know, when they remember the past, they only remember the abuse, the regret, the terrible things that you remember people saying to you. And some of it really did happen, and some of it you exaggerated because as a child you were more vulnerable, because you kept dwelling on it, you ruminated on it, and each time you told that story, the story got worse and worse. So, for example, you know, you remember your father was neglectful. And what you're remembering is one time you were eager to see him. He came home from work. You jumped on his lap, and your father said, "Later, I'm tired." Well, he was tired. He commuted 3 hours. He had a bad day at work. And in fact, did he not tuck you in bed that night? Did he not buy you a present the next day? Well, you don't remember that. What you remember is the disconnect between your eagerness to see him and the fact that he was not fully responsive at that time. So the past is largely a reconstruction, but because it is, the good news that we say in the time paradox is even people who qualify as past negative on our scale. And in our book, you can take our measure. You can do it online. We have a wonderful website, thetimeparadox.com, and score it. And you'll see you get a profile of these different time zone scores. And then we tell you if you score above or below this percentile, then you should consider yourself high, average, or low on that time zone. But in general, to be past negative has much more bad qualities associated with it. This is where depression comes from. But we also found these are people who tend to be angry, vengeful. These are the people that always want revenge for past wrongs. So a key to happiness is converting that past negative at least to neutral and maybe into positive zone.
What's really extraordinary is in reading your book, you have some examples of people who, by any objective standard, had a horrible past and are still able to focus on those few things that are positive. You had a woman in the book who had been in a concentration camp at the time she was 16 years old.
Oh, Edie Eger, who's a psychotherapist in La Jolla, was in Auschwitz concentration camp with her mother and her sister, and her mother gets cremated on the very first day, and she's living there with her sister under these horrendous conditions. She was a ballet dancer forced to dance for Dr. Mengele, this infamous medical doctor murderer at Auschwitz, in return for a piece of bread that she could share with other people. And she comes out of that saying, you know, my whole life has to be organized around giving back to people. So she's a therapist who helps many people who to survive abuse, spouse abuse, tragedies, and is one of the most positive people I know. So you don't get crushed by those experiences unless you focus on the negative rather than the positives.
So it does seem like we might come pre-wired to approach time in a particular way. How do we go about changing our perspective so that we can be happier with the way we deal with time?
Yeah, in the end of the book we say that what's really critical for every person is to try to develop what we call a balanced time perspective, an optimal time perspective, which includes healthy doses of future orientation, past positive, and present hedonism. That any one of those in excess is bad. To be past positive, even though it means you link to family and friends, you have a sense of identity over time, you don't like change. You don't like new people, new things. And in a world of globalization, a world like ours, which is changing, you are stuck in the past, even if it's a good past, because the good old times were the good old times. It doesn't prepare you for new things. If you're future-oriented, you're going to be successful in school, you're going to be successful in business, but you're going to be willing to sacrifice friends, family, and fun. And that means, when you get to the end of the line, when you're the successful middle manager, you look back and you realize that you have sacrificed all of those important things. And as I said, if you're present hedonistic, you're going to have a good time with life, but you're going to end up broke, you're going to end up sick because you never get health checkups, you don't eat healthy foods. So the optimal balance is a strong dose of past positive, low past negative, a strong dose but not extreme future orientation, and a moderate amount of present hedonism. See, all the books on time management always focus only on being more future-oriented more efficiently. And we're saying, no, what's wrong is you have to program in timeouts. When you get a job done, you got to reward yourself. Take a massage, take a hot tub, have a really good dinner, go out to a movie, call your best friends, check in how your parents are doing. And we don't do that enough. I mean, our society is getting excessively, obsessively future-oriented. And in the long run, that's bad for the individual, and I think bad for the culture.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Philip Zimbardo is my guest. He's professor emeritus at Stanford University and past president of the American Psychological Association. His book is The Time Paradox, The New Psychology of Time That Will Change Your Life. Let's speak to John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hey, Chris and Philip. Chris,
hi, John.
I'm going to change my question, Chris, from what I told the screener.
Okay.
I want to get to the cultural aspect of time. People in different cultures, how they experience time.
Absolutely.
In looking at the Olympics in China, we're talking about a lot about the human rights and this and that, and a lot of what I hear from the Chinese culture is we're forgetting the past, we're moving forward. Chinese are very good about putting the past behind them, whether it's Tiananmen Square or the Opium Wars, and moving forward. The Russians, on the other hand, remember World War II like it was yesterday and the Napoleonic invasion like it was last week. America, it seems we have very little sense of the past other than let's have bygones and move forward no matter what we did to each other, but let's make money together and move forward. Can you discuss the cultural aspects of the perspective of time?
Thanks,
yeah, no, that's a wonderful, wonderful point. What we say in the book is that the reason these time zones are so powerful is because they are influenced by many, many factors. It's not just one thing or the other. That culture plays a big role, and I'll mention that in a moment. We mentioned geography plays a big role. The closer you are to the equator, the more likely you are to be present-oriented. Religion plays a big role. Protestants, in general, are much more future-oriented than Catholics or people from other religions, partly because of the Calvinist revolution. When you say the Protestant ethic, what that means is you work hard now and become successful because that's an indication that you were likely to be selected to go to heaven rather than hell. Education plays a role. The more educated you are, the more you move from present to future orientation. But what's critical is you have to grow up in a family with this relative security, in a society that has relative economic stability, because at bottom, to be future-oriented means you have to put trust in other people. You have to have faith that what you do now is going to pay off in the future. So if my father says, if you're a good boy, Phil, you know, I'll buy you a bicycle. And I'm a good boy, and he comes home, and he says, I lost my job. I can't buy it. You know, he tells me again, I work hard. Comes home, he says, somebody stole it. After that, I stop believing that he can deliver on his promise. So I stop having trust that what I do now is going to have the payoff. The important thing about culture is that almost every culture promotes one or more of these time zones in a whole variety of ways. My family is Sicilian, and in Sicily and much of Italy, there's a heavy orientation toward the positive past, a heavy orientation toward hedonism, and almost no orientation toward the future. In Sicilian, I just learned, there is no future tense verb. How could that be? I mean, how could that literally, how could you plan without a future tense verb? Well, you don't plan very well. And in other cultures, let's say like Japan, what's happening now is women have been focused on the past. That's what the women do, tea ceremonies that go for hours. The men are focused on the future. Let me get past it. The men are focused on the future. I'm carrying this. I'm so sorry.
It's okay. We've all got multiple lines. Don't worry.
But now the current generation is becoming present hedonists. They want to shop till they drop. It's an MTV generation. They're dropping out of school. And you're having these huge family conflicts between mother's past-oriented, father's future-oriented, and the kids are present-oriented. And unlike other cultures, kids can't leave home because they can't afford separate housing. So that's a recipe for basic conflict. Anybody who's traveled around the world knows if you go to Mediterranean countries, everything is mañana. Never put off today to what you could put off tomorrow. It's a different concept of being late. I mean, being late is you get there whenever you feel like, rather than, you don't live by clock time, you live by event time. And so Americans get crazed. They say, how could you, you know, everything is so inefficient. But when you travel to those countries, you see it as charming, except you wouldn't want to live there for that reason.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Robert in Plano. Hello, Robert.
Hi, Chris. You're doing a fabulous job with this show.
Thank you.
I'd like to say that I think you're the next Terry Gross.
Well, thank you. That's very sweet.
And I agree. I've been on the program before, and I've done lots of interviews where the interviewer has not read the book. Somebody wrote a few questions, and it makes a big difference if you want to think.
Thanks.
Okay, here's my comment and question. What you said about the people living around the equator not seeing changing seasons, so they don't plan for them, that makes so much sense. And there's my question is about the gender differences. Men don't see the same cyclical changes that women do in their lives. What sort of difference is there between men and women's perception of time?
In general, a lot of our research has been with students, college students, not only at Stanford but all over. And in general, we find female students are more future-oriented. It now is the case, almost from kindergarten on, female students get higher scores than male students. More males are dropping out of college, of high school, than women. There's no question about that. And I think the reason is this basic difference. Guys, from high school on, can spend 12 hours locked in video games. Women don't do that. I mean, you know, women look at it and say, yeah, it's fun. You do it once, and you say, it's a waste of time. And guys get obsessed with it. So this gender difference is really profound. And you're hinting at the menstrual cycle as something, you know, that you know is a periodic thing that occurs regularly. You know it's coming. You know it's going to have change in your mood and your body. And then you get past it. So that it might just be, you know, built into every woman is this a different psychological clock linked to their biological clock.
We have an email from Ruth listening online who asks, how can these abstract concepts be communicated in simple, concrete terms to a 14-year-old gang member with very short-term goals?
That's a really good question. And actually, John and I worked with juvenile delinquents around Stanford in San Jose. These are kids who are in alternate schools about to be kicked out. And one of the things we did was to work on getting them to imagine something happening 2 hours from now, a day from now, a week from now, so that essentially we were getting them to meditate on a future event, to think about it vividly, because in talking to these kids, their future was the fantastic future. There's a kid who's a good basketball player, and he wants to be LeBron James, or he wants to be Michael Jordan. That's never going to happen. And so we get him to imagine, making the high school team. We have him imagine what he has to do to make the team, that he has to practice defense as well as offense. And we did this for several weeks. And it's essentially starting with a very short-term future and trying to build in a little more, a little more, a little more. And all our results show that it was very effective in getting them to go from a fantastic, improbable future to a much more focused, possible future orientation.
When you talk about that, Philip, it occurs to me that it probably takes a special skill set or talent to communicate with people who have a very different time perspective than you do or than anyone does.
Oh, absolutely. If you just listen to the speech, you just focus on the verbs people use, that, kids who are present-oriented are all using present tense verb, where it is, what's happening. Their language is much more emotional, much more locked in present tense verbs. They hardly ever use will be, or shoulds or will. So that's one thing that language obviously controls your thought, controls language, but language comes to control your thoughts as well. So essentially, you've got to listen to how they are describing things, and you have to use their language. One way this has an enormous impact, for example, is, I know you're going to take a break, so...
We've got about 30 seconds, so go ahead.
All of the propaganda about getting kids to stop taking drugs, to stay in school, is focused on the negative future consequence of taking drugs. That doesn't work for present-oriented kids. That works for future-oriented kids, but they're not the ones who are taking drugs. So all of our messages to young kids are usually in the wrong language.
We are talking to Philip Zimbardo. His new book is called The Time Paradox, The New Psychology of Time That Will Change Your Life. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Philip Zimbardo. He's professor emeritus at Stanford University and the past president of the American Psychological Association. His new book is called The Time Paradox, The New Psychology of Time That Will Change Your Life. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Charles in Denton. Hi, Charles.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Chris. My question for Philip has to do with I was thinking about artists. Like, I can show someone how to draw something, but they literally can't do it because they don't have the patience. You got to start work from light to dark, and it's a very slow, time-consuming process. At least the method I use is. So I was wondering, is that something with a person's time perception, or something that changes, or is it just obsessive personality? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, that's a really interesting question. In most studies comparing even students at who are present versus future-oriented, the present-oriented kids lose out. They come in second place in solving mate. And a lot of the research I present in the book, 30% fewer Stanford students solve mazes effectively if they're present-oriented and future-oriented. But the one place where we show that being present-oriented is good is if you get people to paint. We give them a vase of flowers, and we say, paint it any way you want. We give them crayons, we give them paints. And if we say, we want you to get involved in the artistic process, they score highest on creativity. The things look nothing like, they're not objectively similar to the flowers, but art critics, graduate students in the art department who rate them as significantly more creative than future-oriented kids. However, if you tell them, focus on the product, we're going to have this evaluated, then they do the worst. So what's really important is to try to get people involved in the flow of the moment, not to think about what is this going to look like when it's all over, who's going to evaluate it, because that's what future-oriented people do. They want the A. But to get people who are present-oriented like the kids, like most young kids, is how do you get them involved in the moment? So it's finger painting. It's splashing paint. And so you get them feeling the joy of the artistic process. And then gradually you say, well, let's work on using charcoal. And, you know, and therefore you have to hold a piece of charcoal in a certain way. You have to use certain strokes. So my sense, I'm not an art teacher, obviously, but I would go from their strength is getting hooked into the flow, to the process, and then gradually move them toward building up the technical skills. But I think it's the same with sports. I mean, kids who, you know, like in basketball, you know, everybody now just wants to dunk the ball. Everybody wants to, you know, take three-point shots from way out, and they never learn defense. And if you don't learn defense, you're not going to make the team. So it's starting where the strength is and then saying, that's really great. Let's now add something that'll make it even more effective.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Wosu in Grand Prairie. Hi, Wosu.
Yes, hi. How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah. My question is it possible to believe that an individual personality can affect his or her ability to forget the past and go along? For instance, somebody that is an introvert, is it possible for such a person to be locked in the past?
Oh, yes. Well, I used to do research on shyness, and shyness is obviously highly correlated with being introvert. It's not the same. Introverts are people who usually prefer solitary activities over social ones, and shy people are ones who would really like to be more social but inhibit themselves. That the problem with introversion is you tend to live inside of your head more often than extroverts. That because you don't socialize as much, that means you spend a lot of time reflecting, rethinking, reconstructing things, and you don't give yourself enough time to be in new situations that can change your outlook, that can change your mind. So introverts tend more often than extroverts to lock in to a different way, to a particular way of looking at the world, and they're not open. They don't open themselves to new ideas, to new people, as much as an intelligent extrovert would.
Beyond the sort of graduation from childhood and adolescence to adulthood, how common is it for people's basic time perspective to shift depending on the stage they are in adult life?
Yeah, my colleague Laura Carstensen at Stanford has a whole research program on the elderly. And what she shows is that elderly people, because they become aware of their mortality, they're becoming more and more frail, shift from being, you know, distant future-oriented to be more and more, if you will, present hedonistic, in the sense that they select friends, they select family, a smaller number that they invest more emotion in. So that they narrow down, they reduce their circle of contacts, both friends and family, so that they in fact can have a more intense emotional experience. So, given a choice, would you want to spend, you know, an hour a day with a really famous person, or would you rather spend that time with your good old friend? When you're young, you want to spend it with the famous person. And as you get older, no, you want to spend that time with something that's familiar and friendly. So that's one change. Again, it all depends on your health. You know, as you get older, if you're sickly and frail, then you get into that thing we said earlier. You get into survival mode. That what's really matters all the time is your pain, and you're taking medicine for it. So one of the reasons to stay healthy is, you know, to keep a positive time orientation. To say, enjoy the present. Be planning, even if tomorrow is just tonight. I mean, even if it's just planning what I'm going to do tonight, what I'm going to do tomorrow, But it's always wrong to be stuck in the moment, to be stuck in the present.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Barbara in Grapevine. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. My question is, this is related to American business and how they're relating time now. It seems to me that nowadays the emphasis is on the next quarter. When I was younger, it was like 2, 5, and 10-year plans, basically. And how is this happening, and what's the effect?
Oh, you're right on. I mean, it's devastating. The effect is devastating because, you know, you're right. It used to be a 2-year plan, a 5-year plan. Now everything exists at most, you know, for 3 months. And what that means is all of these businesses have this very short-term future. Well, lots of things take time to develop, take time to nurture, to mature, to emerge. One of the reasons most business are against things they have to do to reduce global warming is that it might cost you money in the next quarter, might cost you money this year, even though you could show that over time you will save money. But they are living for the stockholder report. At the most, they have a year vision. But more often than not, as you say, it's a quarterly vision. Well, the world is not arranged in quarters. Only the stock market is. And so a lot of our leaders, certainly our business leaders, in our sense, have a narrow future orientation, which is wrong because in many cases there has to be the longer term thing. So, for example, to retool your cars so they get better mileage and stop focusing on it has 620 horsepower and it can go from 0 to 60 in fraction, you know, in 6 seconds. That's what we were pushing all this time, and then we realized, here are the Japanese cars, here's Prius and Honda, that people are buying more than American cars, and they didn't tool up. They could have retooled, you know, much sooner, but that would cost them money in the next quarter and the quarter after that.
You write that we're not nearly as good at managing time as we are at managing money and sort of tangible resources. Why is that?
Yeah, because we think of it in too simplistic terms. We're unaware of how any one of us has a biased time perspective. That one of the arguments we make in the time paradox is, here's this thing that I'm arguing influences every decision you make, and you're unaware that you are excessively future-oriented. You're unaware that you're excessively present or past-oriented, and that you're also unaware that a lot of the conflicts you have with other people are time zone conflicts, that you attributed them to their stubborn, their ignorant, this one's a visionary and not linked into reality. So part of what we're trying to do in the time paradox is say, step back, take a moment, analyze what are your time zones? Where do you live? And is it the ideal? Is it the best place for you to be living in? If so, stay there. But for most people, it's not. Most people are excessively future-oriented, excessively present-oriented, excessively past-oriented. And in the long run, not having a temporal balance is not good for you, and it's not good for your country. It's not good for your family, for sure. And it's really not good for your country.
You write in the book about being a small child, and you were very sick for a long time and hospitalized when you were 5 and 6 years old. And that caused you to become very future-oriented.
You know, when I was a child back in 1938-39, I was 5 years old, I developed double pneumonia and whooping cough. Whooping cough is a very contagious disease. Its incidence is low now. But all poor kids in New York were put in the hospital called Willard Parker Hospital for Children with Contagious Diseases. TB, tuberculosis, polio, scarlet fever, diphtheria, whooping cough, hundreds, thousands of kids from age, 2 years old up, were put in this hospital, and it was 1938-39. There was no penicillin, no sulfa drugs, meaning no treatment. You lie in your bed 24/7. I was there for 5 months. When I was 5 years old, I went in before Christmas. I came out Easter time, and I just survived. It was genetic roulette. Kids all around me were living and dying, and it was a nightmare because they limited parents visiting to 2 hours one day a week on Sunday. You know what a week long is to be away from your parents when you were a little kid? It's forever. And then on Sunday, sometimes your parents didn't come because there was a snowstorm, and nobody had, poor people didn't have phones, so you waited, and they didn't come. So you realized you had to be self-reliant. You couldn't depend on your parents to deliver. You had to, in my case, you know, I decided in order to survive, the first thing you had to do was get the nurses on your side. So I ingratiated myself. I always made compliments, what pretty eyes you have, because all the nurses had to wear masks. You know, pretty eyes you had, and you got extra butter, you got extra sugar if you did. I invented games for the kids to play that were our beds or rafts were going down the Nile to catch the white alligator. And so I became very self-reliant. I became a social creature, even though I'm in this asocial environment. And I developed leadership skills. But the main thing is, this was a hell. This was a nightmare. And in my mind, I converted it to a heaven. I said, I took what was the few things that were good about it. I learned to read and write before I went to school because all we had were comic books that we recycled. And I would tell the older kid in the next bed, you know, what is this word? And he would tell me, and I'd look at it, and the nurse would give me a pencil, and I'd try to copy it. So it's possible to convert a hell to a heaven, just like Edie Eger converted Auschwitz concentration camp into, you know, a positive therapy that she does, how to get people to go from surviving to thriving. So changing your time perspective is possible. You just have to open yourself to new experiences.
So now, Philip, at 75, when you are hale and hearty and very much engaged with the world around you, but you know, realistically, you are at the end of your life rather than the beginning, how do you focus on time now?
Oh, and the main thing I do is I add a lot more hedonism. Namely, I get a massage once a week. I work really hard. I'm at the computer for hours. I used to commute 2 hours to Stanford. Although I was an athlete as younger, I ended up sedentary, sitting down. And I never had time for massage. Once I started doing it, I realized it was good for my body. It was good for my outlook. So I get at least one massage a week. Now that I'm retired, although I'm working hard writing books, I prepare dinner each night. My wife, Christina Maslach, works at University of California, Berkeley. I have flowers, we have candles, we have a sit-down dinner, very romantic, we have some wine. So just that little thing, putting a little extra time in making the present more open, more positive. I spend lots of time on email, and I answer almost every student's email. I don't answer every email, but I answer student email because it means something to them. So well, I'm trying to live a fuller life now than I did when I was younger, fuller temporal life.
You are proof positive that it is working. Philip Zimbardo's new book is called The Time Paradox, The New Psychology of Time That Will Change Your Life. You can find him online at thetimeparadox.com. Philip, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris Boyd. Anytime.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.